Good morning, or good afternoon, and good evening. Thank you for hanging in to the very end. I guess this is around the top of the ninth, so I'm a Cubs fan, and I guess that makes me Mitch Williams, so we're not entirely sure what's going to happen. I'm very glad to be here. I'm a law professor by trade, so this is a really nice opportunity for me to address a very different group of folks than I normally do. And I've spent the last 3 years thinking far more than anybody should about the infield fly rule, which as an abstract idea, the idea behind it is we want to eliminate the perverse incentive for an infielder to intentionally not catch an easily playable fair fly ball in search of a double play. And therefore, we can eliminate an extreme cost-benefit disparity that would come with that double play. What I want to do here is look into the underlying numbers and see how and how well the infield fly rule performs that function, does what we're hoping that it will do. And there's three components to this. All right. Number one is the frequency, how often the situation comes up. Number two is how likely the evil to be prevented is. How likely is that unfair double play in this situation? And then number three is what's the effect of the rule on actual runs and at-bats and innings and games? Or really more specifically, what would be the effect if we were to repeal the rule on runs and innings and games? And that's what I want to look at. So first is frequency. We looked at the last five seasons of Major League games. We identified every time a player came to the plate in a quote-unquote infield fly situation. That is, first and second, no out, first and second, one out, bases loaded, no out, bases loaded, one out. And then we identified every time that the infield fly rule was called, or the infield fly rule is in effect, as every announcer puts it. And the total, the total we can see in the lower right-hand corner, a little bit over 46,000 plate appearances in that situation. There were 1,228 total infield fly calls, about an average of about 245 per season, or 2.6% of the time that it might have happened. The two high seasons were 2010. With 260, and then just behind it this past year with 253. The most frequent situation, both for plate appearances and infield fly calls, as you would expect, is first and second and one out. 580 of the 1,228 total infield fly calls were in that situation. And by the way, that 1228 does not include about 50 or 75 balls that I couldn't tell whether infield fly was called or not. You just couldn't determine it from looking at the video. It looked like it could have been or should have been, but I'm not sure. I left them off of this. So to the extent that there's an accuracy here, it actually undercounts how often it gets called. By percentage terms, interestingly, the greatest frequency by percentage is actually the two bases loaded situations. For most of the seasons, they were over 3%, including in 2012, bases loaded one out was our single high percentage of 3.7%. All right, so second question, how likely is the double play? How likely is the evil that the rule or the problem that the rule is designed to prevent? Now, this is something that we can't measure empirically. We can't go back and replay the game without the infield fly rule. We can't go back and determine what would have happened under a different set of rules. What we can do, though, is to use the location of the ball on the field as a very rough proxy for the likelihood of the double play. So what we did was to chart every infield fly call for each of the five seasons. The chart on the left is balls with first and second. The chart on the right is bases loaded. And you can see the numbers and the distribution for all five seasons. The open circles are balls hit with nobody out. The closed circles are balls hit with one out. The open squares, such as this guy right here, are balls on which infield fly was called. The infielder didn't catch the ball, but the runners didn't advance. The closed squares, such as this guy right there, I think I'm pointing at the right one. These are balls on which infield fly was called, the infielder didn't catch the ball, and the runners did advance, or at least they tried to advance. This play right here was in a, it's actually a little higher. This was a Mets-Dodgers game from last year where the second baseman dropped the ball, the runners got confused and ran, and Yasiel Puig got tagged out, just kind of wandering lost between second and third. And anytime people can make fun of Yasiel Puig, of course, they're going to take the opportunity to do it. The triangles, which you can see a little bit further out into the outfield, these are those balls that I mentioned a couple minutes ago where it looked like infield fly could have been called, maybe even should have been called, but I'm not sure. I included them on the charts, but just for to get a sense of placement. So in thinking about this, we want to make three assumptions. And the first is that the closer the ball is to the infield and or to the target base, that's the first base that the infielder is going to throw to start the double play, the more likely the double play is. Shorter throws, okay, more likely that you can make the two throws necessary to get the double play. And the more likely the double play, the greater the incentive for the infielder to try this, the greater the incentive for the infielder to intentionally not catch the ball and see if he might, if we took away the infield fly rule, that he might be able to turn the double play. Second assumption, that without the infield fly rule, infielders would be doing this intentionally. They would be intentionally not catching the ball. It's not just that they'd be dropping it when they meant to catch it. They actually would be intentionally letting it fall to the ground. But that means they'd be better able to turn the double play because they're going to position themselves well. The ball's going to fall in a way that's convenient for them to pick up. They're going to surround the ball. They're going to be able to pick it up, and they're going to be able to make those throws. So it's going to be a much easier play. The double play is going to be much easier for them to try to make. And then third, kind of relatedly, if you took away the rule, infielders would practice this and they would get really, really good at it. They don't have an incentive to intentionally not catch the ball right now. But if you change the rules and you give them that incentive, these are professional baseball players, they will get pretty good at it. So with those assumptions in mind, what can we glean from this? Well, I think it's fair to say that a double play is likely on almost all the balls on the infield grass and on the infield dirt. All right, easy to control, close throws, and the infielders are going to be in a good position to get themselves ready to make the throws that are necessary. I also think that the double play is still a pretty good likelihood as you go a little bit further into the outfield and onto the outfield grass, where that first throw is going to be to third base. So that is everything with first and second, and bases loaded with one out, where you can get the double play going third to second. So I think that covers everything a lot of these balls from just to the right of second base all the way over to the left field line. All right, it's a short enough throw that it might be worth the risk for the infielder. Now, one of the things we do see in that respect, though, is some wide variance, because we see, for example, in 2011, there happened to be a lot more balls hit into the outfield grass on the right side of the field than on the left side, but that season was kind of an outlier. We see in 2014 a lot more balls on the left side of the field. On the other hand, I think the double play is significantly less likely the further into the outfield you go. So we've got this little lonely filled-in square here on a drop ball. This is from the 2012 National League wild card between the Braves and the Cardinals. My apologies to any Braves fans who are in the audience. This is actually the play that got me started down this rabbit hole. I also think that the double play is less likely on balls behind first base and sort of along the right field line. And I think the throw there is going to be too long. And for that, whether the throw's going home or the throw's going to first base. And so I think the incentive isn't there for infielders to try it. But again, we see some wide variance from season to season, because here we see a pretty big cluster of balls in this area in 2014, but by comparison, we see hardly any in that area in 2013. So there's going to be some season-to-season changes. Now, fortunately, we don't have to entirely speculate on this because we have this play. This is from a July 2013 game between the Angels and Twins. The Twins had first and second, nobody out. The batter hit this little kind of flare-ish thing just to the right of the pitcher's mound. You see the pitcher moving over to field the ball. You see the second baseman retreating back to second base, and so far this looks pretty normal. Except the pitcher stopped moving and let the ball drop right in front of him at his feet. The umpires did not call infield fly for a particularly good reason, and the Angels got a double play on this play. Actually, could have gotten a triple play, except the pitcher threw to the wrong base. What this shows, I think, is that fielders will try it. If you repeal the infield fly rule, infielders would try this, all right, if they thought on the right ball, all right, and it will work on the right ball. The question is, how often does the right ball occur? How frequently does the right hit occur? And the charts that we looked at suggest pretty frequently. All right, third. Can we measure the practical effect that the rule has in terms of run production and its effect on games? Now, recall how the infield fly rule operates. What we're trying to do is stop the infielder from intentionally not catching the ball and getting a double play on the two base runners, not on the batter and a base runner, but on the two base runners. And the way the rule does this is by imposing an outcome on the play and taking away the incentive for the infielder to not catch the ball. So with the infield fly rule, he's going to get the same outcome on the play, one out on the batter, all right, and the runners are not forced to advance and in all likelihood are going to stay put. He's going to get that same outcome whether he catches the ball or not. And therefore, we take away the incentive to not catch it. But if you take away the infield fly rule, suddenly the double play becomes a possibility. And that double play is going to be on the two lead runners, most often on the two lead runners. And if this all happens with one out, the double play is going to end the inning. All right, so with that in mind, how can we try to measure the practical effect? Well, one way is through run expectancy, which is the number of runs on average that a team is expected to score from a given base out situation until the end of an inning, until the end of that turn at bat. So what I looked at was the change in run expectancy on the batter following the infield fly, because that's the guy whose situation is going to change. Because with the infield fly, the batter's out, the runners in all likelihood stay put. So the next batter comes up with one more out and the same base runner situation, same number of runners on base in all likelihood in the same position. All right. Without the infield fly rule, that guy is coming up. If we assume the double play on the infield fly, then the next batter is coming up with two more outs, one less runner on base, and again, if it all happened with one out, the double play ends the inning. He's not coming up to bat in that inning at all. He's not going to hit until the next inning. So it seemed to me that the difference between the run expectancy in those two situations gives you an indication of the effect that the rule has. So, for example, take bases loaded, nobody out, in 2014. So with the infield fly rule, the next batter, you get one out on the fly ball, runners stay put. So the next batter comes up with one out and the bases loaded, and a team in that situation in 2014 had a run expectancy of a little bit over 1.5 runs for that inning. Without the infield fly rule, assuming the double play, the next batter comes up with two outs and runners on first and second. A team in that situation had a run expectancy of a shade under 0.4 of a run. The difference, a little over 1.1 runs, that's the loss in run expectancy without the infield fly rule. That's the average runs that the team will lose if you change the rule. So what do we see? We see a pretty significant, I think, loss in the two no-out situations. So bases loaded, no out, it's a run expectancy difference of about 1.1 runs on average, so a loss of 1.1 runs per inning. First and second no out, it's about two-thirds of a run per inning. The effect on with the one-out situations is a little bit less pronounced, in part because the next batter, or the batter up after the infield fly, without the rule, he would be leading off the next inning. So he's batting with nobody on and nobody out, and that's actually a reasonably favorable run expectancy situation. So the difference, so with bases loaded, one out, the difference between hitting with the bases loaded and two out, which is where we are with the infield fly rule, or leading off the next inning, it's only about two-tenths of a run higher in bases loaded and two out, so it's not that significant a difference. And it actually is turned on its head for first and second and one out, because the run expectancy is actually higher for the guy leading off the inning than it is for a batter hitting with a runner on first, or excuse me, with runners on first and second and two out. It's in terms of run expectancy, you're better off leading off the inning. Now, would you rather have first and second and two out in the fifth or be leading off the sixth? Probably depends on whether you're winning the game or not. And then the last thing I looked at was to try to measure the runs lost, or the runs that would have been lost without the infield fly rule. So for every infield fly call, we looked at how often runs were scored in the same inning subsequent to the call, all right, with the expectation being that since without the infield fly rule, we're going to assume the double play. Some or all of those runners are going to be knocked off of base, and that means they're not going to score, or at least they're not going to score in that inning. So one indication might of that might be one indication of the runs that were lost. So we see of our 1,228 infield fly calls, on 375 of them, runs scored subsequent to the call in the same inning. So we can say, okay, some of those runs might have been lost. If we look at first and second one out, of the 580 infield fly calls, and that, again, that's our most common situation, runs scored subsequent on 115 of those. And again, those are runs that we know are not going to score, at least not in that inning, because the double play is going to end the inning. excuse me. Then what I did next was, once I identified when runs scored subsequent to the infield fly, we then looked at how often that affected the outcome of the game, in the sense that if you took away those post-infield fly runs, the outcome of the game changes. Either the winning team loses, or you end up in a tie game. We don't know how the game ultimately would have come out, but at least it would have marked a change from the actual result. So of the 307, so of our 375 total infield flies. Where runs scored subsequently, on 107 of them, the runs would have made the difference in the game. They either would have changed the winner or would have produced a tie. And it's of our 115 with first and second and one out, 32 out of those 115, the runs affected the outcome. Now, this is an admittedly imprecise measure, because we can't test the counterfactual. Maybe some run, maybe the rest of the inning would have played out differently and those runs would have scored. Maybe the rest of the game would have played out differently and those runs would have scored. We just don't know. But it's still illustrative. I think it gives us a sense of the possible effect on particular runs and at-bats and innings and ultimately games that that taking away the rule might have. So I'm going to stop there And I'm happy to talk about the normative conclusions about that we can glean from these numbers. Although ultimately, I think that's going to depend on the preferences that you bring to the conversation. If you are a fan of the infield fly rule, and I will admit to being one, you're going to think, well, the numbers kind of support this. I mean, it's, you know, 1,000 plus, you know, it's almost 250 plays that would have been very, very different each season. If you're not a fan of the rule, you're going to say, it happens 2.6% of the time. No, you know, less than 3% of the time, what's the big deal? So I'm happy to talk about that in Q&A, as well as if I'm not an empiricist by trade. So if folks have other thoughts on ways to measure this, I'd love to hear it. Thank you. Questions? Yes, sir. Right. You know, mistakes are going to, did everybody hear the everybody here? It's basically that if the problem is that there are balls that go a little too far into the outfield, or that the runner is still on the move, is that a potential problem? I think the umpires actually handle that well, because the way they explain the judgment call they make on it is that they look at two things, neither one of which is actually mentioned in the rule. And one thing they look at is arc. Is the ball hit high enough in the air? And the other thing they look at is the fielder settled under the ball? So they apply the rule in a way where they want to minimize that situation, because if the fielder is still moving, they're not gonna call it. And from what I've seen on video, they're pretty good about that. I didn't see a lot of ball. I'm nothing that really jumps out at me like, boy, this guy went a really long way and he was still running when he caught it. They're pretty good about waiting until the infielder gets settled. Now, there's a balancing act that needs to be done, because you're right, they do have to call it quickly enough to put everybody on notice, but not too quickly that, you know, if something strange happens with the wind, it's going to end up with a, you know, in a strange situation. Yes, sir. I'm not sure I follow the question. Right. No, you know, I didn't look at that situation, because there's no rule, or there's no concern, I don't think, for the infielder to In the only situation where there's an incentive to try to not catch the ball is the situation of a runner on first, where you know you may trade a fast runner for a slow runner, and the rest of it, you never want to do it in a way where you're not going to get at least one guy out, either the batter or that runner that you're going to be able to force out going from first to second. Right, but if he just lets it, but if he's smart and just lets it fall to the ground, he's going to be able to get away with that. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, I didn't break it out that much. So for purposes of when I wrote this up, for purposes of these numbers, I just assumed a double play on everything. Just for purposes of collecting the numbers. No, I think that's a fair point. It may be on some, because some of these infield fly calls were probably balls where the outfielder, even without the rule, would not have had the incentive not to, or the infielder, excuse me, would not have had the ball. Had the incentive not to catch the ball. No, you know what? I did not break it out that far. I just looked at anything that would change. Where the team that won the game would not have necessarily won the game. And that, you know, and it, you know, I might have been under-inclusive on that one, because what I didn't include was, you know, if we won 5-1 and we scored 2 post-infield fly runs, well, when you take those away, we still win 3-1. You know, maybe you need to include that as a game affected because, again, we can't test the counterfactual. We don't know how it would have played out as a closer game. Other questions? Thank you very much for sticking it out.